Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything, from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
Hey guys, welcome back to Breaking Banks. I am your host, Brett King. Breaking Banks is the number one global fintech radio show and podcast. I'm actually down in Australia this week recording the show, which you're going to hear from our friends at Verizon this week in terms of cybersecurity. Really interesting show. But I am down here pre-recording. That's why I've got a bit of a croak, because I came from the warm summer weather in New York down to Australia. But it's just me. Don't have anyone co-hosting. Okay, in the news, I don't know if you've been watching the fintech space, the challenger bank space down in Australia, but it's definitely heating up. My mates Steve Western at Vault and Eric Wilson at Zinger are both on fire right now with their provisional APRA licenses, but I think we will hear within the next 8 to 12 weeks that both of these guys will be launching with their full banking license. So that's exciting. There's some real progress being made here. If you're watching other news, then of course the big news this week is, apart from Donald Trump's tweets about Libra, we do have the congressional hearings about Libra that is happening this week. So no doubt there's going to be a lot of stuff in place. The big push that's it's emerging is that really it probably will be incumbent upon Libra to get some sort of banking charter. I think they must have some regulatory status in place, so with payments licenses and so forth. Facebook's been working on that for a while, but the Facebook guys have argued Libra is not a cryptocurrency, that it's based on a blockchain, and that it's it violates the decentralized vision of cryptocurrency, which I think we could all agree with. But it does have certain controls to reduce risk and volatility for consumers. So, but there is still some risk for consumers. So maybe Congress has a line to play there in terms of that. In other news, we see that Curve has picked up a $55 million Series B funding. So congrats to those guys. We see Raisin preparing for their U.S. launch following their $25 million capital raise €25 million raise. Despite Brexit, UK is on fire, with the fintech sector seeing record growth there. And also out of the UK, we see the FCA, the Financial Conduct Authority, looking to explore how AI will affect consumer finance. This is not limiting AI, but the implications will be on how, when AI is implemented, how it is explained to consumers, how it's going to be affected. Don't forget that in London, Cybos 2019 is coming up in October. Brian Cox will be delivering the opening InnerTribe keynote. I'm a massive Brian Cox fan, so for Dave Birch and I to be on the same stage as Brian Cox, it's like I'm starstruck. I'm totally going to be geeking out. But if you're there at Cybos in London, make sure you come up and say hello to Dave Birch and I. We'll be doing some stuff for the show there from London. So that's it for the news and the conference announcements really this week. I want to get straight into the show we recorded earlier this week with Verizon on cybersecurity. Well, as you guys know, Verizon has been a great supporter of Breaking Banks over the months and years, and we're very glad to have them back this week talking about security matters. And there's a recent report that Verizon and one of their partners, the Global Resilience Federation, worked on, which we're going to get into, basically looking at how organizations can assess various threats to them, and how we're starting to see organizations emerge on a global basis that sort of tackle these issues from a more structured perspective. So we're very privileged to have a couple of great guests on the show today. We have Brian Sarton. He's the Executive Director of the Global Security Services Division of Verizon. Brian, welcome to Breaking Banks.
Thank you, Brett. Good to be here.
Tell me, first of all, what's Global Security Services?
Well, that's Verizon parlance for three things. I have our cyber investigations business. You may know us from our annual Verizon Data Breach Investigations Report, Insider Threat Reports, and Data Breach Digest publications. I have our cyber intelligence function, known as the Verizon Threat Research Advisory Center, or VTRAC. Super exciting place to be on top of Verizon's great big network, handling the cyber intelligence end of the spectrum, but also have our security consulting functions, Brett. We're in about 30 countries.
Very good. And also joining us today is Bill Nelson. He's the Chief Executive Officer at the Global Resilience Federation. The GRF members span 7,000 organizations across five continents. And so, Bill Nelson, welcome to Breaking Banks.
Thank you very much, Brett. Yeah, we're a Global Resilience Federation. Really is comprised of a number of different industry sectors, including finance, healthcare participation, law firms, retail. We also have oil and gas and energy. More recently, we've added another group of professional services, accountants and consultants to the mix.
So you guys call these units that come together under the Global Resilience Federation Information Services Exchange, is that right? Or ISACs, what is that?
Yeah, the ISAC is a term. It was developed in 1998, and the Financial Services ISAC was the first one. And it stands for Information Sharing and Analysis Center.
Right.
So it's information sharing with government in the private sector. It's also member-to-member sharing, which I think is the greatest value, and then also sharing with other sectors. And I think we kind of bring all that together under this one big umbrella.
Very cool. And part of what we're going to get into is really, the training responses, the crisis response, the reports you guys do, the indicators of threats or compromises that are coming out regularly, all of those things. So I want to dive into this. Let's start with one of the terms that you guys use that our audience may not be familiar with is from a threat perspective, you talk about a hierarchy of threat. Maybe Brian, do you want to have a first shot at sort of defining what that is for those who aren't familiar with sort of cybersecurity?
Yeah, we look at and track different facets from our cyber investigations, starting with elements like where the breaches come from, vector of intrusion, the types of data that are stolen, breach victim demographics and facets like that. There's so many ways to look at these. But I think some of the, at the top level, hierarchical elements or classification, if you will, that's, let's say, most relevant to many audiences is the breach external? Coming from the internet through a broken window, for example, or is it an inside job involving employees, past or present, or a partner-related breach involving, B2B type of business partners, whether those you have a direct or indirect, relationship with. On the other side, across those three, you also have this notion of threat actor or criminal motivation. For example, is it a financially motivated attack? Does it involve an ideological actor bent on disruption, denying or destroying an entity's ability to conduct business, for example, or just revenge? Or is this an espionage type attack, state-affiliated, corporate espionage, or otherwise? And these are, two of the most popular categories anyway.
Now, Bill, in terms of members of the GRF, is the key benefit there both getting a heads up on sort of the types of attacks that are occurring? Is it more a network that works in respect to action and responses?
That's a great question. There's so many different, aspects of an information sharing exchange, if you will. Part of it is giving you a heads up that this attack is occurring. And I know when I was at the CEO of the Financial Services ISAC for many years, 13 years. And when I started there in 2006, there wasn't much sharing going on or If we got information from the government, it was not relevant, not really actionable or dated. That started to change in about 2008-09. There started to be more really active sharing among the members. We developed a real trust network that really made a difference. And of course, the membership grew. We started out with a few hundred members. When I started there in 2006, there were 7,000 by the time I left. And part of that was the attacks got more frequent. The need to share information, even about how to remediate the attacks, how to prevent them, to improve your enterprise defenses. And it was a lot of the members sharing each best practices about that. And I look back at some of the massive types of attacks we saw, and Brian alluded to different things that you have. You have data breaches, and there were big credit card data breaches in the about 2009-10 timeframe. Account takeover, where you click on a link and all of a sudden a bad guy is in your home banking system or business banking system and moving money out and sending it via wire transfer overseas. And then you had these denial of service attacks, which I mentioned, the massive denial of service attacks that we saw, big, massive botnets that would attack a bank and legitimate customers couldn't get into the bank to do their banking transactions because these things were so massive. That was attributed, some of that in 2012 and 13 was attributed to Iran. Brian also mentioned the hierarchy and classification. We see data breaches as one type of attack, distributed denial of service attacks. I think more recently seen even destructive malware, things like wipers that basically wipe your systems completely clean of all data.
We've seen ransomware recently with even some cities or councils in the U.S. having to pay millions of dollars to get critical infrastructure back up, right?
Yeah, and some of them didn't pay it and they're still suffering. So, and you always have the risk that the key to release the encrypted databases and systems won't be provided, even if you pay the ransom. So it's a very tricky situation. So yeah, that's probably the worst type. It's been hit hospitals. It's hit all different sectors, especially government sectors. Like you said, cities have been hit. I think the big one in the U.S. that caused everybody to wake up was Sony Pictures a few years ago. And there were many aspects that Sony Pictures hacked. Part of it was emails that between executives and talking about actors and things like that were kind of juicy information. But it was also a massive wiper attack, too. 800 or so servers were wiped, thousands of computers. They couldn't produce financials for 6 months.
Wow.
They had no idea who they owed money to or owed money to them. So it was a very significant event. And it was a big wake-up call for all industries, banking in particular, because a bank has to produce financials. I mean, they have to know how much money they have, et cetera. And it was a big wake-up call for them and led to a lot of improvements in security and risk controls.
And, of course, that was intimated that it was a state attack from North Korea over the content of that that film. But, you mentioned, Bill, that a few years ago, when you would try and collaborate with the government, you would get information from the government, but it wasn't relevant. It was always outdated and wasn't particularly relevant. But that seems to have changed. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, I think they realize one of the problems we had, and there's still a problem in a lot of other countries, but I know in the U.S., the person that really had a big impact on that was actually Robert Mueller, who's in the news for different reasons but... He was the director of the FBI, and the FBI at that time, I'd say in the 2009-10 timeframe, they would not really share the indicators of compromise or the tactics, techniques, procedures used in an attack. They felt they had to keep that information. It was called law enforcement sensitive. They would keep it within the FBI and not share it because they wanted to build a case against the cyber criminals.
Right.
As you know, a lot of these cyber criminals, though, are in countries that we do not have extradition treaties with. So that really policy was very short-sighted. They started to change that under Mueller, and they realized that they really needed to first help the victim, in this case, many companies that were being attacked and government entities, but also inform others, at least the information about the indicators that they could look for those. Maybe the executable file that contained the malware, the attacking IP address, for instance, other information that they could use to block the attack. And that change has been huge. And the FBI, Secret Service, and others have been really instrumental in improving the public-private sector sharing that goes on today.
And so that's where the resilience factor in GRF comes together, because it what's more critical is limiting the damage rather than thinking about enforcement later, which may or may not happen, right?
Exactly. I think you hit the nail on the head. I think you don't have resilience without intelligence, and you need that information quickly and as fast as you can. So a member, for instance, and it can be any sector. Let's say it's the oil and gas sector in Singapore or transportation sector reporting an incident that may affect a financial institution or another oil and gas entity in all right around the world in the North Sea or in K or here in the U.S., you might see the same attack within a few hours or the next day. So it's a global problem, and it has to be immediate, the sharing.
Right. So the faster you share information, the more chances are that people can put up their defenses and stop it, or at least
exactly.
Restrict it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, Brian, you guys must be considered by the U.S. government as critical infrastructure. So what sort of relationship operationally does Verizon have with the U.S. government and the departments that Bill mentioned, so that you guys can ensure that, you know, the critical infrastructure of Verizon's network is kept safe?
Yeah, well, it's a long and colorful story, Brett. We are interconnected at a number of levels, both for intelligence sharing, as well as how to, let's say, develop and make sure that we adopt best practices, not just Verizon internally, but Verizon as part of a critical infrastructure community, adopt, develop, and promote and encourage, let's say, industry-leading practices around proactive and reactive elements of information security in general, but also cyber resiliency. So interconnected, of course, ISACs, as Bill covered, CERT organizations in the U.S., a number of other countries as well, and a number of different ISAC communities, you know, at that level, certainly participation in some of the, you know, original, like FS-ISAC, some of the most developed there, of course, the communications ISAC, the multi-state ISAC, so ISACs at a number of different levels, but also with certain government agencies and so forth. So we know that we have the right operational security readiness in the event that, you know, some type of an emergency happens that affects Verizon as critical infrastructure or the community at large.
When we're talking about the sort of teams that banks and financial institutions have to put together for this, it sounds like that this is a pretty big moving target. So if you guys are working with the ISAC for financial services or whatever, you know, how do those teams develop and keep on top of the sort of skills that you need for this and the technical capabilities?
You mean ISAC teams or, let's say, enterprise?
The members, yeah, the actual corporations that are members of the ISAC. You know?
Yeah. Well, I think that, you know, on one hand, you have the idea of getting your finger on the pulse of industry recognized best practices and standards with respect to defensive countermeasures, security strategy, also incredibly important for security leaders to understand the real world types of threats that their industry or sector faces. One of the reasons why we put out the types of publications, Brett, that we do, to help kind of illustrate in a data driven way, and you slice through all the fear, uncertainty, and doubt in the security spectrum, you know, what types of real world threats are relevant and real in one sector versus another. You know, those define, you know, not only what you're likely to face, but what types of countermeasure strategies really work and make a meaningful impact against those. So certainly, you know, those types of preparations laying the right foundation for smart security, both at a point in time, but smart security for a period of time. So that ability to maintain secure status. But, you know, moving operational security up to another level, Bill touched on so many elements there that are so important, I think, is the interconnection through security strategy or security sharing and intelligence sharing type of models like FS-ISAC. Understanding what trends and mitigators and catalysts are affecting other entities in a given sector. Understanding what attack types are relevant and are happening or affecting one entity or another in the sector, and understanding the types of security measures or steps that really work against relevant types of attacks and threats that are actually happening. I think you have operational security foundationally within the enterprise, but then you have sharing arrangements that expand the enterprise's knowledge and vision of what's happening in the sector, you know, but also more broadly. And that's something that's really afforded, I think, in the best, most tangible ways through some of these sharing type structures like ISACs.
No. Yeah, this is Bill again. I just want to add to Brian's comments. I think one of the really outstanding reports that comes out every year is the Verizon Data Breach Investigations Report. And I look to that every year. It's one of the almost like the holy grail, if you will, of really information about what's happening in various sectors, the number of attacks that they're seeing, the types of attacks that they're seeing. And that really helps management and these firms to beef up their defenses and realize where the trends are happening too. What I saw in this last report, the 2019 report, is that a lot of different, I would call it the third parties are being attacked. And because they have sensitive information, or they can get to the ultimate goal the company that they're trying to get into or infiltrate or get a data breach against. And we saw that repeatedly in the past happen. I think the most famous case is when Target was attacked and through an HVAC vendor in Pittsburgh. They got access into the systems, the bad guys, and hacked into tens of millions of credit cards. It's happened again and again.
Their POS software was compromised as well, wasn't it?
That's right, yeah. And so the POS system was hacked. There were some issues in terms of a lack of encryption between the swiping of the card and to the ultimate POS system. So yeah, they had some deficiencies in their software that came to light, which they quickly fixed and repaired. But those types of lessons learned are important. And third-party risk, I think, is really important. We put on a third-party risk summit. We started to do it last year. The healthcare sector put it on, and they actually turned it over to us to reach more sectors to really emphasize the risk that third parties have in terms of having sensitive information. Could be a consultant that might have sensitive information or accounting firm that, in the wrong hands, it could be intellectual property, it could be stealing of IP, intellectual property, to create a new industry in some other country that would steal it. That's a very common thing that's been happening lately, particularly with certain countries in Asia, one large one in particular, that's been done that repeatedly, China. And so I think that report I really look to. And then the new one, that internal risk report, Brian, I don't know if you want to talk about that, but that was a new one. I really found that interesting, the internal threat that you might have. Insiders, most people think of insider threat.
Just to reinforce what Bill's saying there, the Verizon Data Breach Investigations Report, you can find it online, and we'll put out the link on the show, social media as well. But 34% of data breaches and attacks involved internal actors versus 69% outside. And one of the other things that's interesting out of this report is that 43% of breaches involve small business victims. So it seems like the bigger organizations are doing better. You would expect that more smaller businesses with less IT infrastructure would be victims of this. 52% of breaches were featuring hacking. 33% included social attacks, so social engineering. 28% involved malware, and errors were instrumental in 21% of breaches. So some really interesting data there. Definitely, if you're interested in this cybersecurity field, there's a lot to break down in there. Brian, if you got anything to add on that before I ask you the next one?
No, I was going to say, I think you did. You definitely did some weekend reading there on the publications. Thank you. I think that comment is very appropriate on the smaller enterprises, those with fewer than 1,000 employees. We've been tracking the ebbs and flows of breaches by the numbers of victims, certainly the sectors and subsectors. But if you look at the size, there has been an interesting change. You know, in that last calendar year, we've gone from the predominant numbers of victims being larger enterprises to all of a sudden being significantly smaller enterprises. And within that, there's an interesting trend that's starting to develop. You see the types of smaller entities being hit the hardest tend to be professional services firms, which is one of the reasons why GRF and Bill, getting out and starting to establish better interconnectivity and sharing circles within that sector, I think is so appropriate from a timing perspective. You look at professional services firms, particularly accounting, tax firms, and law firms being targeted within that, that breach demographic. And it's interesting if you put yourself in the mind of a criminal, the kind of data that can be compromised in those types of breaches. They're not necessarily cyber attacks or data breaches that lead to the theft of information that is very valuable for resale, in as much as breaches that can lead to other third-party targets of opportunity. In other words, stealing data that can be used to set the stage for another third-party type of a cyber attack or data breach. It's a really fascinating trend we see developing around the small to mid-sized business sector.
Mm, very interesting. So that leads me to really ask, there was two questions I had coming from this. One, Brian, was how you prepare or how you keep Verizon as a corporation, geared towards defensibility and resilience in respect to this. But first of all, I'd like to ask Bill, how often do these ISACs meet? Because it would appear to me that one of the really critical elements of sort of good communication in respect to these threats is the actual network working effectively and people just knowing each other and knowing who to call in this community.
Well, if you ask the question, how often do they meet? Well, they're doing it all the time. It's operational online real time. So you might be sharing information all the time. You see an incident, you report it right away. So usually during business hours in your respective time zone. But building that trust is the key, and the trust model is very important. You'll have maybe some resistance from your internal law department, legal department about the sharing. You have to overcome that. And I remember in the history of this back 10 years ago, before there was a lot of sharing, there were a couple financial institutions in New York that decided to assign someone on their staff to start sharing everything. And when that started, a whole trend among all the mostly the larger institutions to start sharing. And that they realized the benefits because they were able to prevent attacks as a result. There was another instance, I think it was about 4 years ago, maybe five. Remember the end of life for Windows XP? I think it was in April, about 5 years ago.
Yep.
And a couple months before that, these community banks and credit unions realized that 85% of their ATM machines ran on XP. And they said, oh my God, what do we do? So they started sharing best practices and what they were looking at in terms of other systems or way to kind of continue to run on XP or upgrade. And that went on for 2 months, produced some papers out of that. And the community banks haven't stopped sharing since. They formed their own network of
That's great.
Talk. So they've been actually one of the most active groups of sharing within at least the financial community. So yeah, I think if you ask me how often do you meet, well, you're not necessarily meeting person to person. You might do that twice a year, maybe at a conference or there are a number of big events that happen around. There's some smaller events. I know I was at a Verizon event recently and got to speak at it. And there were a lot of financial institutions and others there that they got to see each other and share some information, but it wasn't really tactical operational data that they were sharing necessarily. It's more high level strategic discussions, which are very important too. So I think that I'd say that's almost as important to understand the strategy and preparing for future threats.
I get it. All right. Well, listen, guys, let's just take a quick break. And then after the ad break, Brian, we'll get your comments on how you communicate these issues to the broader firm at Verizon and your clients effectively. And we can get into some other stuff like, upcoming preparedness in terms of breaches and so forth. All right, you're listening to Breaking Banks. We're talking cybersecurity and global security on the web and on digital, and we'll be right back after this break.
Hey guys, it's Brett King from Breaking Banks here. If you guys haven't heard about Roan, you're missing out. Roan is my favorite men's performance lifestyle and premium activewear brand. It's engineered for superb quality, amazing comfort, and for guys like myself, an absolute necessity when you're on the go. Now, it doesn't matter if you're training in the gym or, like me, you're constantly on international flights. I think they're the new go-to men's clothing brand. Now, my wife Katie and I recently signed up to the gym. I realized I was overdue for some new workout clothes, so I bought a pair of Roan's Torrent pants. They're comfortable for the gym, but I also realized that they look good enough and formal enough that I can wear them when I'm on the go. And they're great for spending time on airplanes. They're durable, they're stylish, and they've just Roan has just released their amazing new commuter collection. So this is the stuff that I can wear on the plane or in the office, looking great and staying comfortable. That's the style and versatility of the commuter collection. You guys should check it out. They offer everything from pants, polos, shorts, and shirts. They're lightweight, comfortable, wrinkle-free. It's good for all weather and available now. To Breaking Banks listeners with a special 20% discount off your first purchase. All you need to do is go to roan.com/fintech today and use the promo code fintech. You'll get 20% off your first purchase. That's roane.com/fintech. The promo code fintech gets you 20% off thanks to Breaking Banks.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Breaking Banks featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag Breaking Banks. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Breaking Banks, and we are talking with Brian Sarton, the Executive Director, Global Security Services of Verizon, and Bill Nelson, the Chief Executive Officer at the Global Resilience Federation. So, Brian, before we took our break here, one of the things that we were talking about is how you guys stay prepared as the Global Security Services Division within Verizon. But I'd like to get into how do you help executives and others across the broad corporation at Verizon be better prepared for this? How do you educate them on the threats? What policies and procedures do you have in place that limit the risks to Verizon as an entity?
Yeah, well, I'm happy to speak on that. Certainly, I play a role as part of the security apparatus at Verizon. And, a lot there to secure if you consider both the B2C or consumer sides of our enterprise, and you look at the retail, for example, and online aspects of those businesses. You certainly have our B2B side as well, Verizon Enterprise or Verizon Business Group. And if you look at Verizon's infrastructure that supports that across the different customer connections that that we have and maintain every day. And of course, across, I think behind the B2C and B2B sides, you've got, the massive network, wireless, the telematics, the traditional internet service provider and telecommunication sides of the business. There's a lot of moving parts there, and securing those takes a very interesting combination of overlapping layers to make it work, not only to lay the right foundation, but to actively detect and respond to potential issues that crop up on that. I play a very interesting role in that most of global security services is outwardly facing. So of all the consultants that we have around the globe, and I mentioned, 30 countries, and we have almost 600 consultants deployed across 30 countries, working with customers, some of the biggest enterprises in most every conceivable sector, you know, from things like vulnerability management to compliance management to threat detection and analytics to cloud security, you know, to mobile security vulnerabilities and all these different aspects, breach response. And we learn a lot from the course of that work. There's tremendous intelligence and sort of a thumb on the pulse, if you will, on what are real world cyber attacks at a given point in time in certain pockets of the globe and in certain industries versus what they aren't, but also what types of defensive countermeasure strategies really work versus those that definitely do not work. And that kind of intelligence or that visibility, that thumb on the pulse, if you will, that's something we're constantly trying to package up and drive back in to Verizon to kind of help sweeten the pot and better put that intelligence at the fingertips of all the different operators and analysts and engineers and so forth that, you know, that drive security across the different aspects of Verizon that I mentioned earlier to kind of drive those, you know, every day, all day, every day. Now, publications have certainly come up here, Brett.
All that asset that you have, all of that learning and data, you also make sure your clients have that, right?
Well, that's absolutely right. So what we've found is there over time, there's some interesting, let's say, and unique aspects of the security and cyber world that we do have, I would say, a certain special thumb on the pulse of. For example, cyber attacks at a given point in time, the nature and types or hierarchy of those threats, if you will, certain views on inside jobs and other trends that might be prevalent at a given point in time at an industry affecting or targeting certain asset landscapes. So what we try to do is understand what's real out there and where are the areas that need the most improvement based upon understanding what real world cyber attacks are really looking like. And that kind of a need to get that data out there to slice through fear, uncertainty, and doubt, and let's say better equip security and industry leaders to stay out of the headlines as the next victim. You know, that's been a mandate and a priority here at Verizon for a long, long time. It led to the creation of our data breach investigations report publications back in 2008, the data breach digest, the inside threat report that Bill mentioned, which is a first of its kind, we just released. We also have our data breach digest publication, mobile security index, payment security reports, and a number of others that that are designed to do all that kind of a look behind the curtain, if you will, on what's really happening in the cyberspace and what to do about it.
If you had to hazard a guess, and I don't know if you've got an exact number on this, my guess is you probably don't, but how many people do you think are employed at Verizon that have either their dedicated focus is cybersecurity and threat detection, analysis, and response, or partially?
Well, across our chief information security officer and our chief security officer and some of the most significant divisions, they're numbered in the thousands.
Yeah, well, impressive. Now, so one of the areas that's getting a lot of news lately, and I did want to touch on this, and I know you guys probably can't go so deep into it, but you know, one of the threats we saw emerging over the last few years was foreign actors getting involved in things like the election campaigns and on social media, skewing or creating a momentum behind different views and so forth. So, you know, what aspect does that sort of cross over with the cybersecurity side of things, Bill?
That's a great question. I'm pleased to report that one of the latest information sharing and analysis centers, or ISACs, that's been formed is an election ISAC. It really brought together federal government, state government, municipal governments, and brought them together to start sharing information about what they're seeing. Law enforcement's heavily involved at a national level, FBI and others, and at a state level and local level. So we see cyber expertise from government in all aspects coming together to share information on how we can protect the election process in this country.
This has sort of put me off in a different tangent. I'm gonna shift course here pretty rapidly, because while I was talking about this, one of the things that occurred to me is that when you're looking at the specific attacks, like phishing and so forth. That identity is really a key element of this, tied up in this. So one of the things you've got with like Facebook, the social media compromise and stuff like that that we're talking about is really knowing that the person is who they say they are. And from an identity theft perspective, when you talk about, say, banking or telecoms, the theft of someone's social security number and enough data to mimic them is sort of obviously a key issue. So are you guys thinking about the identity infrastructure we need that might provide better resilience in respect to, you know, stopping things like money laundering and fraud and identity theft?
Yeah, I mean, just from my perspective, yes, absolutely. And there's so many indicators that kind of lead us down that path and thinking about that. I mean, I think one on that human factor with respect to phishing, spear phishing in particular, and the potency of that. I mean, that, you know,
can
that,
you describe,
that idea.
For those that aren't familiar, because I didn't define this, but what is phishing and then what is spear phishing when it comes to, cyber threats?
Yeah, that's fair. So phishing, of course, would be sending out, let's say, a single email to many hundreds or thousands of recipients in the hope that at least one of the recipients might, open an attachment which could spread malware onto their computer or create an unauthorized access outlet for the originator of that email to gain unauthorized access to assets or, let's say, a laptop or desktop, you know, belonging to the individual that opened the message. So phishing is generally a one-to-many type of message, where spear phishing is a one-to-one or one to a small number. Spear phishing, the crook tends to know much more about, like, for example, from Facebook or other online information. They know a lot more about the recipient, and that gives them a better ability to craft or tailor that message such that the recipient is more likely to open it, to read it, to click on the attachment, or to follow the links inside it, or otherwise fall into the trap.
And so this is where the social engineering part of the more sophisticated attacks can occur, right, Bill?
Yeah, and that's absolutely right. But that, you know, the human factor is definitely here to stay. You know, you say from our publications that 88% of enterprise employees will not statistically click on a phishing or spearing message, but, you know, the other 12% will. That's the problem. And right. Our research further shows that if they're likely to click once or twice, they are likely to click 4 times, 5 times, 10 times, or 20 times on those messages during a year. So it's so critical for the enterprise to understand their population of 12%, who they are and where they're located. Awareness certainly is a big facet there. But getting more specific around the identity piece is this interesting facet behind breaches, putting the human factor away. And you look at the prevalence of two-factor authentication as a mitigating factor. You say that about 4 out of 5 intrusions today involve the exploitation of stolen, weak, default, or easily guessable credentials. So 4 out of 5, that's a huge number. And almost 100% of that attack surface, that risk is mitigated with the consistent usage of two-factor authentication. In other words, the authentication infrastructure that is still in use today by so many enterprises, and this is true at the government level in many countries, is weak enough around just traditional usernames and passwords and weak password security that it's an easy avenue of exploitation into many enterprises. And if that isn't available, phishing and spearing or general social engineering, the human factor is the second easiest route.
But do you think that we're actually at the point, I'd be interested in your comment, because this is something that I've said when I've done my talking head stuff, is that the identity data we've previously used to identify someone, so your mother's maiden name, your date of birth, your address, your social security number, that data is really no longer securable, that we need, like, two factors a good step, but we really need to move to things like biometric identification and so forth?
Yeah, this is Bill. I think so. And in law, there's a concept of what's commercially reasonable, actually, in the law, in defining liability, for instance, between a company and a bank in originating, like, wire transfers. And what came out of it was there's been a number of court cases where the banks have been ruled against because they were not offering commercially reasonable security procedures, or they weren't following them, or the company chose not to use the commercially reasonable security procedure. They just used user ID password, and they were found liable for multi-million-dollar losses. So yeah, I think that's one of the brilliant parts of pieces of our law. This was in the, I don't want to go into it, the Uniform Commercial Code, but and this was all passed in the late 80s or maybe 1990. And I think that's really made a big difference. And I agree with you 100%. It's not commercially reasonable anymore. User ID password. It's just not.
Yeah. Now, when we start getting into identity frameworks that are sort of more robust in the digital space, you obviously get, you have a situation now where when I come into the US through ports, I'm likely going to be subject to facial recognition, fingerprint analysis to ensure I am who I say I am. But of course, and of course, China is now using this in mobile payments and a broad range of initiatives. And there's some debate about whether that is appropriate. And but we've recently heard about San Francisco talking about banning facial recognition. And so how do, you know, what's it going to take, do you think? It seems to me fairly inevitable that at some point in the future, we will be basing access to systems on technologies like facial recognition. What do we have to do to close the gap in terms of educating the public around the fact that a username and password and this sort of identity data that banks and telcos have been collecting for years is not enough to keep them safe?
Well, it's actually there to protect them. So I think some of these so-called privacy advocates have it wrong. And you're really keeping the data safe and protected and secure. I look at Apple. I mean, they've gone with facial recognition. They had already done fingerprints, some earlier versions of the iPhone. And, now they've gone to facial recognition for that. I mean, I think that is the wave of the future. I mean, Brian, do you agree with that? Or?
Oh, I think, yeah, I think more easier to enforce. Second and third factors of authentication, biorhythms, ocular, the mental map projection concept, things like that. I think they're
heuristics. Yeah.
Yeah. They're inevitable. And we see the value in that, definitely with facial recognition and so forth. I think anytime you have a real disruptor in an area, as facial recognition has been, I mean, the adoption of it on mobile devices, for example, it's become such a disruptor around authentication. It's almost inevitable to me that you see a lot of the privacy advocates that Bill mentioned kind of jumping up and saying, oh, wait a second, what's the countermeasure around the personal liberty side of that when this information falls into the wrong hands? Legitimate concern, but I think ultimately that concern is going to be assuaged because the technology is going to be adopted anyway out of necessity.
So we've seen Canada put in place a secure key identity. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that, but it's sort of a consensus-based mechanism that they're trying to introduce where banks and telcos and government departments, trusted parties, will be in this consensus group that will share identity information. Because the concept that every telco in America and every bank in America should be collecting the same identity information over and over again, that itself seems a little flawed. So what would it take to get that sort of consensus-based approach to identity in the U.S., do you think?
I think it's going to be a challenge. I think in Canada, you have five major banks. They can do a lot more things in terms of consensus around payment systems.
Than 11,000 in the U.S.
Yeah, 6,000 banks and about 6,000, maybe 5,000 credit unions, but a lot different. And then you have the many different types of businesses, and it's just a more difficult process. And in the states, we even have more states than they have provinces, and it's getting the consensus is going to be tough. I mean, would you agree, Brian?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's a lot, it's probably quite a bit more difficult to operationalize something like that here, not to mention to adopt the concept in the first place. But it's a good undertaking. If things like this, when they are successful, I think there's some, net benefits for those that adopt the approach or the technology.
So maybe what we see happen is an identity broker like a Facebook emerge with a blockchain-based currency system that, you know, who knows? All right. Well, listen, guys, we're running out of time. So what I do want to do is two things. First of all, Bill, who are you looking to join as members of the Global Resilience Federation? And how would organizations get in touch with you in respect to that?
Yeah, we're looking, you know, for any industry that needs an information sharing organization or wants to be part of one. You can contact us on our website. It's www.grfederation. So it's grfederation.org. We're a nonprofit company and really supporting, you know, many different industries. So, you know, you're welcome to join.
Yeah, if you guys want to contact the Financial Services ISAC, then they actually have their own Twitter address. It's FSISAC. So you can tweet them out and get connected there. And Brian, the reports we've talked about, the data breach investigations report and these other reports that you have for your clients and for individuals concerned about this sort of thing, where can we find those?
At VerizonEnterprise.com.
And is there, you know, some other way they can get in touch with your team, Brian, if an organization wants to engage more thoroughly on the cybersecurity side with Verizon?
Yep. Yeah, there's certainly, there are handles to reach us through on VerizonEnterprise.com, or you can get us on Twitter at Verizon Enterprise.
Great. Fantastic. Well, guys, it's been a really interesting show, and I'm very grateful for, you know, having a couple of really solid experts in this field give us some more information. And I'm glad we've got people like you protecting us out there.
Yeah, my last word is don't click on links.
Don't click on that. Don't open documents from people you don't know. Yes.
That's well, even if you know them, they might be spoofed.
I had that actually. I had that with, I've got, I'm good, you know, we've got an investor out of Boston, hedge fund guy, Jim Pallada. I hope Jim doesn't mind me mentioning him. And I had someone, and their URL was really similar to his URL, and that's what got me. But when I figured it out, it was because I hadn't clicked on any links or anything. I figured out it wasn't him when he asked for when the guy asked for money, because Jim's a billionaire. He wouldn't be asking me for money, right? So that was a giveaway.
That's a giveaway. Yeah, that's good.
Anyway, thanks guys for joining us on Breaking Banks, and we'll make sure all that contact information gets out there. So as I mentioned at the start of the show, the UK fintech scene is on fire. Brexit or no Brexit. US fintechs this year have reached a record level of $2.9 billion in the first funding in the first half of this year across 123 deals. That is on track to beat last year's $3.3 billion. They're almost there, and it's halfway through the year. Now, deal volume has declined, but we're talking about bigger deals that have emerged. So we've got Oak North, Monzo, Starling Bank. Each of those have raised, or collectively those guys have raised in excess of $600 million between them. So there's a lot of really interesting stuff happening over in the UK. Of course, despite or apart from the Brexit shenanigans that are going on, we also have a change in leadership right now. So it looks like at this point, it's more than likely that Boris Johnson will defeat Jeremy Hunt as the Tory leader, making him the next Prime Minister of the UK. So I thought we'd do a quick flashback to an interview I had with Boris Johnson in July 11th, 2017, and to see what he had to say about the UK's approach to fintech, why London was a great center for fintech technology, and more importantly, how there was an opportunity for the US and the UK to collaborate on a fintech across the pond. Here's what Boris Johnson had to say when he visited New York City back in 2017.
What makes London a great destination for financial technology?
Because we've got the banks, we've got the biggest financial sector anywhere in the world, but we've also got the expertise. We've got more people involved in that sector than any other part of any other European capital, probably any capital in the world, and it's growing the whole time. We have the brains, we have the coders, we have the young graduates, and it's a fantastic place to live. I think that is why London is winning at the moment. It's just because of the quality of life of the city. It's the buzz, it's the bars, it's the vibe, it's all that kind of stuff that, you know, people like me can't really screw up too much. You know, it's done by What we can do is make sure it's safe, and it's clean, and it's green, and there are enough houses, and the transport is good. That's what we do, and it's working well.
And how do you think New York and London can collaborate on and bringing technology to the banking sector?
Just recognize that this is win-win. Both of our, obviously, New York and London will always be in competition to some extent, but there's a sense also in which the better New York does, the better London does, the better London does, the better New York does. They are two very similar economies. Breakthroughs in New York will instantly be replicated in London. Breakthroughs in London will be instantly translated to New York. It all moves ahead of the same thing.
Boris Johnson, thank you very much. Great to meet you.
That's it for another Breaking Bank show. Thank you for joining us this week. And our sincere thanks to our sponsors, Verizon, and their continued support of the Breaking Banks show and Provoke Media generally. Now, please do join in on the conversation. If you want to have an active part in our community, join in. Tell us what you want to hear. Tell us what guests you'd like to see on the show. Tell us what we got right. Tell us what we got wrong. That's really important to us, to be in tune with what's happening out there in fintech land. On Twitter, we're at BreakingBanks1. On Instagram, at BreakingBanks. You can follow us on Facebook, of course, BreakingBanks there. Or you can just email us at info@provoke.fm. Now, don't forget, you can go to provoke.fm and you can find a back catalog of all of our shows, more than 300 shows over 6 years from Breaking Banks. And of course, our other shows are there too. FinTech 5, Serial Entrepreneur, Breaking Banks Asia Pacific with Simon Spencer, all available at provoke.fm, or check us out directly on breakingbanks.com. Another thing that's really important to us is support from the audience. So if you can, go to iTunes, if that's where you download from us, or podcast, or Google Play, or wherever it is you listen to the show, and give us a 5-star review. That helps other people find the content, and it's always appreciated. And also, don't forget, you can share the show on social media. So if you found something you really loved on the show this week, don't forget to tweet it out. All of that's really important for us to continue to grow our membership, which is 6.5 million people across 180 countries last year. So we really appreciate your support. Thanks for making us the number one show in fintech in the world. We're Breaking Banks. We'll be with you again next week.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for more of the latest in fintech news.